Hello and welcome again to Oscar Mike Radio. My name is Travis, Marine Corps veteran and your host. Oscar Mike Radio is co-produced with Sinister One Productions. What's your podcast doing? I want to thank my sponsors, Joyce Asek of Asek Real Estate, Danielle Rocca with Echo 6 Creations, and my supporters, Caisson Shaving Company, Fight Camp, and Exceptional Parent Magazine. One of the things that I discover and have discovered during Oscar Mike Radio is just how much I don't know about the veteran experience, about things like PTSD and MST and other things like that. And I welcome every opportunity to learn and share with you. And my next guest embodies that. I want to introduce Dr. Carla Strump Patton with TAPS. And it's just a very special show for me because I'm getting to learn from someone who lives this every day. Doctor, welcome to Oscar Mike Radio.
Thank you, Travis. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for allowing me to be a guest and talk about this important topic.
You know, we're going to get into the whole breadth, or try to get to the whole breadth of what this program encompasses. But for those out there, this is a very personal mission for you. Can you give us a little background about who you are and how you got into doing this kind of advocacy, Doctor?
Sure. Well, I serve as the vice president of our suicide prevention, intervention, and postvention programs. By trade, I am a licensed psychotherapist, and my subject matter expertise is in the areas of bereavement, trauma, and suicide, particularly within the military. All of that really comes after the fact of being personally impacted by suicide. When I lost my first husband, my first spouse, he was an active duty Marine post-Gulf War era, where he had served with the ground troops. He was a drill instructor in the Marine Corps, and he died by suicide at the age of 24, 31 years ago. And so I was impacted very personally and profoundly at a very young age. And we were expecting our first child at the time when he died. I gave birth several days after his suicide, and that changed me profoundly. But that also was during a time when there were no resources. It was very isolating. There was no platform for those who've been impacted by suicide to really share their experience, as well as help towards prevention efforts. So that really became, you know, my quest, so to speak, that drove me professionally into this field, and why what I do at TAPS is obviously very personal, but it comes from such a place of commitment and passion and dedication. And the work that we do ultimately is still saving lives. So it's something that also is very hopeful in the work that we do, trying to help those in our military community who've been impacted by suicide.
This resonates with me because many of the reasons I started Oscar Mike Radio was around veteran suicide. I did not experience it like you do. My first real exposure to suicide and its consequences was in the Marine Corps League, when we would go and do burial rituals for veterans who had committed suicide. And it left me very conflicted because I didn't understand, you know, why this was happening at this level and this rate. And I didn't know what to do, Carla. And I started this journey of trying to learn how to advocate effectively for it. My first question is, when this happens, there really doesn't seem to be support for when this void happens to people. And that's the first thing I notice is this event has happened. There's severe loss and a lot of feelings around that. But a lot of people ask me, well, what's next? What do I do next? And that's where I stumble is, am I common in your travels and journey, or is this something that TAPS can help me answer?
Well, TAPS absolutely can help answer that. We've been around for 31 years, and we are really one of, if not the leading nonprofit and organization, particularly around suicide postvention after suicide deaths in the military. And so we are here, and we stand ready to not only support family members, loved ones, next of kin, but battle buddies, you know, comrades, military leaders, because we know that when one person dies by suicide, that a minimum of 135 people are impacted, and that could be very close proximity. That also could be people in the community, in the workplace. It could have been their healthcare providers. And one of the hallmark reactions are the questions around this, why this happened, what could we have done differently? It's really how, those of us who've been impacted by suicide loss, we're left wondering about that. We cannot bring the person back that we love, but it's almost universal that most of us want to learn from that tragedy and in the look back, in hindsight, what could we have done differently? Is there something, to improve the systematic, offerings to help, to encourage people with self help seeking behaviors? So there's so many questions around the, if only and would have, could have, should have, why? And, the only person who can really tell us that is not here. So, as a community, we're left to try to figure this out more. And sometimes if we don't have those answers, it really does help to connect with resources, kind of consulting with subject matter expertise, maybe making sure that we have correct information. And some of that is there's a learning curve, right? So through gaining new information and knowledge and becoming more aware is the first step of that. You're doing that here. We want to try to reduce the stigma around that because it's hard to talk about, and suicide is very complex. It's also, there's no one single answer. People are very individual and very unique, and so each case is very different in itself. And while we know that there are risk factors and warning signs and certain contributing factors, people are also very individualized and very unique. And so it's not something that's easily explained or answered, but there are things that we have learned and that we do know around not just prevention, but kind of upstream, being proactive, preventative measures that can help protect against suicide, that can reduce risk. And a large part of that is the messaging, how we talk about that, how we respond to suicide, and understanding the different facets, whether it's kind of upstream early prevention, if it's intervention kind of in the middle of or the height of a crisis, or perhaps after a suicide attempt, and then after a suicide loss. And these components are all equally critical when we look at protection and risk reduction.
Before we get into all that, you touched on the word stigma, but in my anecdotal personal experience, Carla, one of the parents felt like they were, one, a complete failure as a parent, and then two, this pervasive sense of shame they carried with them because of what had happened. And at the time, and even now, it's still hard for me to understand how to meet them where they are to help them through this. Where does this sense of shame come from, and how do we lead someone or help someone through that part of this healing process?
Well, I think it's important to address stigma from two perspectives. One,
Okay.
the stigma around those who are struggling with suicide. So historically, sometimes whether it's stigmatizing language, or judgmental language, things that might be from cultural or religious or kind of ethnic taboos that keep people from either asking for help. It could be the stigma, within our military culture, if I ask for help, I might be viewed as weak, or less than, which is, it's completely the opposite. And asking for courage and seeking help, or asking for the help, is courageous, right? It's difficult to do that. And then there's also the stigma for those who have been impacted, and family members, loved ones, friends. And sometimes that stigma is self-imposed, what we kind of put on ourselves. And sometimes it's from the society around us who unknowingly might think, well, you were their wife, you were with them every day. Why didn't you see it, or why didn't you know more? And again, kind of like the why, and sometimes finger pointing, blaming, shaming, whether it's at ourselves, whether it's, at the systemic issues, if it's at another person, organizations, because we all are wondering, why didn't somebody notice? Why didn't somebody do something, to help or to intervene? And many times for those of us who've been impacted personally, we do that ourselves too. Why didn't I? notice? Why didn't I, see the signs and do something more or do something different? And even in cases when those of us may have done all of that and we tried at, with our best efforts, it's still very hard to grasp and understand, this the concept of suicide. So stigma in itself is also a very large topic, and so I think it's something we want to be delicate about, particularly for those who are coping with a loss, that we're not implying and shaming in any way. It's quite the opposite, that we want to be sensitive, we want to be compassionate, we want to be caring, we want to understand. And so I would say, if you're supporting someone else, this is something you're not going to have the answers to. You
Okay.
can't fix this, you can't explain it away, but by being present and by listening, and you maybe even listening, what are the needs that people are having? Maybe we can get them connected to resources. Do they want to connect with peers, maybe a surviving parent to connect with other parents, or a spouse with another spouse, or adult children or adult siblings, with their peer group? And sometimes with that, there can be a lot of understanding to feel, to see that you're not the only one. And sometimes it might be connecting to resources to gain that deeper understanding, and maybe to even understand more about the complexity of suicide and some of the contributing factors that, because oftentimes people want to have a deeper understanding of what was, either my loved one or the person who died, what was it to the extent that they were experiencing that it got so bad that this was the only solution in that moment that they saw as being able to solve the problem at hand.
So as I, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I hear that there's going backwards to forwards. There's the postvention, the intervention, and the prevention aspect. Is there another phase we need to be mindful of when talking about suicide?
I think that really, when I explain it and I try to break it down, because it is very enormous and complex, I look at kind of those three particular components, if you will. Of course, from a postvention perspective, that usually refers to either after a suicide attempt or suicide death. After a suicide attempt, which there's interventions that happen then as well, it's still a very high risk time, so we want to make sure that we're still offering really good, competent kind of post intervention care. But really, when you think about the facets of kind of what you said, kind of postvention, which is after either an attempt or after an attempt, a death, intervention is usually in the middle of or during either, an emotional crisis, extremely stressful times, or suicidal crisis. And then prevention really being more kind of upstream, if you will, more proactive, preventative around education and awareness and the things that we want to do before, ideally, a crisis emerges, which we're looking at increasing protection factors and risk reduction and increasing safety. But I think the important thing to think about or to understand is how they are all very closely interrelated. And so many times people might view postvention after a suicide death as grief and loss support, which it is. However, it's much more expansive than that. And so, if I could kind of convey a message, we lead with how postvention has to be incorporated into any suicide prevention strategy, because how we respond after a suicide loss, with the services, the care, the outreach, the support, is critical for future prevention efforts. And I'll explain why, because we know those who've been impacted by a suicide death are at increased risk now themselves for either mental health issues, substance use and abuse issues, suicide thoughts and suicide behaviors, particularly around the fact that the loss is very traumatic in many cases, unexpected. It could be very graphic in details, graphic in detail. And these are the things that increase someone's risk. So when we can provide immediate care when they've been impacted, we drastically can reduce that risk. So when you think about our military community, whether it's active duty, whether it's in the veteran community and our military family members, when they've been impacted by a suicide loss, we know that they can be at increased risk. So how we respond, ideally with very quick, competent care, we're always looking at creating safety and reducing risk. So you can see how it ties right back into being preventative for future efforts that will help save lives.
I wanted to bounce something off of you in this vein then, because I'm not a clinician, I'm not a licensed social worker, I'm not, but I play video games. I'll admit that freely, and I'm playing either Destiny or Call of Duty with my buddies, and we're sitting around talking one night, and it's like, one of them said, "Hey, I used to feel lonely until I picked up my controller again and started being around you all." And that got me down this little rabbit hole. And there's a VA report, and I'll share it with you after the show. I'll email it to you if you want to see it. But it talks about how loneliness and suicide are related. And just unscientifically, it's like, maybe that individual I was playing with found that by coming in the lobby and, busting each other's chops and talking with each other, he didn't feel lonely. And I don't know if it's talked about enough, but I'm just asking, uneducated, literally in this regard, does loneliness ha have is a component of suicidal ideation, doctor?
Absolutely. You know,
Okay.
that can be what we might call like a contributing factor. It
Okay.
can be, a risk factor. And when we kind of look at that a little bit more in depth, let's think about that for a minute. We know that kind of either social isolation or just a sense of loneliness, maybe loss of community, loss of connection where somebody is feeling this lack of belongingness, a lack of connection, we know that is a key contributor in risk for suicide. And so instinctually, what you just said, you're spot on. When we can foster a sense of connection, of belonging, a sense of community. And if you think about in our military, community, while people are active duty, they have a very a much stronger
Yeah.
sense of that in many cases. But why the separation out from that can be one of the most difficult transitions. And, the sense of community changes. You might not have the same amount or frequency or intensity of connection and sense of community. So there is no interaction or person that is too small to play a part in this. So whether it's connecting over a video game, if it's a hobby, if it's something in the community, when you can foster a sense of connection and help to reduce that sense of isolation where somebody feels now a human connection, you might not even be talking about, the word suicide per se, but you're helping to foster that sense of connection. We know that that can be a protective factor, something that can reduce risk. And so for the person who might be struggling with suicide thoughts or maybe not yet, but still feeling a sense of kind of isolation and loss of connection, that can be a tremendous help. And I would say the same could kind of transfer over when you think about those in the what we would call either survivor community or suicide loss survivors, those who bereaved by suicide. That same sense of isolation can still feel very lonely, very debilitating, kind of like this dark pathway, because how am I going to get through this? I feel like I'm the only one. And I can tell you with my loss, it was very isolating. It was a long time ago, 31 years ago, myself, my family, my husband's family, we all felt that sense of isolation. And, that was at a time when the military did not talk about suicide. It was a very different time. So the part that I'm very hopeful about today is that has changed. It has changed tremendously. We're talking about this conversation, and there is, countless programs, organizations, podcasts addressing this. There's money going to this. There are positions as suicide prevention coordinators. There are, suicide prevention departments and organizations when that never existed. So the fact that we're talking about it and trying to offer community, the sense of community where people can connect is tremendous. And then the same for those who've been impacted by a loss, where they too know they're not alone. There are people who have been through this. It doesn't mean it's going to be easier. It's not going to take the pain of the grief away, but it can be a very helpful aspect to still feel a sense of connection. And I think our military community is a very powerful example of that. You know, whether people are currently serving or have served, or they're military family members, we do have a very strong sense of community and how we are, you know, that we are there for one another. We have each other's backs. And so I think, you know, we can lead by example with that, with the many programs that are out there and the diversity around that. You know, maybe video games are not everybody's thing, but maybe they, you know, might connect over sports or, you know, other different hobbies, you know, martial arts or whatever it might be, that they have something that is, there's options, right, that can help them to feel the sense of connection about around what works for them.
Talking about TAPS, your organization, 31 years, and you have a very personal but yet professional alignment to the organization. Let's just say I myself or somebody else says, you know what, I'm not in a good place, and they reach out to you all. Describe for us what's the process like to get assistance from TAPS and what that's going to look like for the person involved, please.
Sure. If I could take just a minute to kind of explain about how
Sure,
we
absolutely.
help others. We are primarily a grief support, a peer-based grief support organization. So our primary mission is really helping all of those who have been impacted by the loss of either someone who is serving or who has served. So we support all relationships, you know, beyond next of kin. You know, we support, you know, family members, you know, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, battle buddies, you know, leaders within units who've been impacted by loss, anybody who has been impacted and needing support around that, including people that we often don't think about, maybe like fiancés and, you know, other intimate partners who they would not qualify for services or eligibility under some program. So we're in that regard very inclusive. We respond and support around all causes of death, around all branches of service and all eras of service, you know, and all duty statuses. So, in that regard, if you have been impacted by a loss in any way or any sense, we are there and we stand ready to help with that. And because over 85% of us who work at TAPS are also loss survivors ourselves, we know as much as anybody the many, you know, the multitude of services and programs and needs that people will need, may be needing. And so we have everything, as you had mentioned, what might that look like? We have a 24/7 helpline where people can call. And so I would say, even if you have not been impacted, but you know somebody who has, you can contact us immediately and we will, immediately kind of mobilize our support, our services, our team around either responding to crisis, you know, responding with outreach with peers and assessing what those needs may be. And so, whether they, you know, go onto our website and do an inquiry or they call our helpline, we will immediately respond with kind of addressing and meeting those needs of care. So, you know, in a hypothetical situation, if there's been a suicide in the community, you know, if it is somebody within leadership and they contact us, we will support leadership and hopefully get connected to family members and other loved ones. If it is in the community in the same regard, or if it's an individual who needs that care. And so whether it's casework assistance and navigating, you know, funerals and burials and benefits and obtaining paperwork, if it is wanting to connect with others who understand, it could be, in the case with suicide, it could be around housing issues or perhaps maybe biohazard cleanup. If a suicide has occurred in a residence, it might not be safe for people to currently be residing there. And these are some of the very kind of delicate and very unique concerns that we know because we have had those experiences, but when we know what those needs are, we usually have programs and services to help meet those needs. And it could be somebody who's grieving deeply at 2 in the morning and needs to talk. Our helpline stands ready to support with that. If it is somebody who perhaps has not necessarily had a loss, but in the military community, if they contact us, We have strong partnerships in this community within the VA, within the DoD, and within every VSO in between. And so we will always do a very personal, warm handoff. If it is something that we don't have resources or maybe it's beyond our scope, we know other people and organizations who would be able to meet those needs. So we will personally do that warm handoff to make sure that whoever contacts us is getting the support that they are needing.
So primarily post-suicide support, but if there's but at all aspects of the suicide, you can either connect somebody with a support system or interface for them to get the help that they need.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting because I've interviewed some people here on Oscar Mike Radio and talked to them off microphone. Just they didn't want to come on the show at all, and they talk about they serve in the military. And one of their, fellow squad mates, sailors, airmen, Marines, committed suicide. And 10, 15, 20 years later, that moment in their life is still keenly felt. So they can still feel the emotion all that time later. And some people have a hard time with that. Why, beyond the obvious, why does that moment stick in their minds for so long? Because you hear the phrase, time heals all wounds, but that doesn't seem to be the case here, doctor.
Well, I think a couple of things. Hopefully I can address all of that. I think in general, we know with grief, that's still not necessarily true. Time does give us the opportunity to reflect and have hindsight and to look back and maybe gain deeper understanding, even in our own healing and our own growth. But it really is the work that is done in that time, kind of what we might call like the grief work, right? Of really being able to process the emotions, connecting to peers, receiving the support, the services that can help. It might be counseling, grief support groups. There's a lot of things involved in that healing. But I think the other thing that what you're touching on that we talk about, particularly with suicide loss, is in addition to grief, there's a very traumatic, sense here related to suicide. It could be the direct exposure to suicide. Without elaborating too much, I can use my husband, drill instructor, Sergeant Richard Stump. He was a drill instructor at the time, at Parris Island when he died by suicide. His suicide was in the workplace. And on that day, there were hundreds of Marines and recruits who were impacted by his loss. There were people who did not know him personally, who were perhaps not grieving, but they were dealing with trauma. There were people who knew him who maybe weren't there that day and maybe had served with him, maybe not dealing with trauma, but grieving his loss. And then there were people both who were dealing with trauma and grief, myself, Marines, recruits, people who knew him, who were there, who were present. These are the things that can make suicide very complex, particularly when you add the element of trauma. So when you have people who, even in hindsight, if it's been 10, 20, 30 years, and there's, maybe some sticking points, of course it's life-changing. You're never going to forget, not only we want to, this person, their life, their memory, but we also don't want them to be defined only by the moments of how they died, because there's so much more to, a person, their life, in this case, their service. But sometimes it can be so profound, particularly when there's a lot of these unanswered questions, right? Like I still to this day, I wonder, like, what could have been done? What got to the point where this was the only thing that in their mind that they saw as an option, and I would say for myself personally, maybe naively too. I mean, we were in our very early 20s, again, expecting our first child within days. So for myself, that was one of those things that I really struggled with, because I thought that wouldn't the thought of a new baby within 3 days, wouldn't that be enough to stop somebody? What we would think today as a protective factor. And these are just, an example of many of the questions that we are left with. And I think along the way, if we have support and resources that we can understand around suicide, it helps tremendously. For myself, I did come to understand that suicide in my husband's case, it was not about a lack of love. It was not about not wanting to be a new father, not loving us, or me loving him. It wasn't about a lack of love. It was about a measure of pain, right? So somebody who is suffering with extreme anguish, psychological pain, maybe physical pain, where in that moment they don't see any other option to escape the pain, right? Or they maybe thought that they are the burden. In some way, people would be better off without them, without them being here. And so I think, as you ask that question, when we think about in that circle of people who are impacted, not everybody's always offered support or care. Maybe they didn't have anybody to kind of process, unpack it, so to speak, talk about like all these complex emotions and questions. And if you don't have peers or somebody to talk about that with, it just kind of stays inside of you. Those kind of questions and the things that people really either are stuck on or they kind of revert back to. And it can be debilitating. It can kind of lead to even kind of trauma symptoms. So what I would say around that is it's never too late. Even if it has been decades, it's never too late. And I would validate that too. This was something significant that happened in your life. If it was a loss or a person that you're grieving, and even, in their life and in their death, if it impacted you, it really kind of highlights the need of why it is so helpful to be able to talk about that and process that. And that is a way that then kind of processing those emotions, we can kind of learn and grow, rather than feeling like we're stuck. Like, I'm still back here. I'm still having the same thoughts. I'm still kind of like spiraling around these thoughts and kind of tormented or haunted by what I should have done or what I wish I would have done, as opposed to maybe learning ways to heal and grow, maybe learn from the tragedy, what we would kind of refer to as post-traumatic growth. I know that's a
So,
big answer, but it's a really good question.
no problem, no problem. And we're gonna, so listening to you, it seems like TAPS has this, process, if you will, to come in and triage and provide a foundation or stability for the situation, regardless, primarily on postvention or post-intervention, but that's your first and foremost spoke of the wheel. Then you help the person do the grief work, and then listening to you and understanding your life story, there is this aspect of post-traumatic growth, and I want to find out more about that because it's like you get the help you need, and what happens next? And you've taken this very real pain that you have to feel and made something out of it. So how does the post-traumatic growth aspect of what you all do works? Doctor.
Great. That's a great question too. Thank you for acknowledging that and asking that. And I would say, I think it's also helpful to think of how in kind of the same concepts could apply to in our military community too, right? Maybe they had a traumatizing experience and they're needing help for that too. So, you can kind of expand it in a greater picture. But ideally, if we can meet people where they're at with that, with the safety, with stabilizing those immediate needs, the things that are very unique concerns, maybe either urgent or emergent needs that we are assessing and kind of getting them support for, so that they feel there's trust, they're safe, that they're getting the care that they need, they're not alone. We're fostering that sense of connection. That in time, and I'm doing this in a very idealistic kind of fast forward speeding up, but we know that grief and trauma is not that way. But for the sake of this, I'm kind of just giving you an
Yeah,
ideal
because
scenario, right?
right,
That when that
healing's not
happens,
linear, is what you're saying.
Absolutely, it's not
Okay.
linear. It's very fluid. Maybe it could be like 3 steps forward, 10 steps back. That is the process of like the therapeutic process. That's the healing process. It's not cookie cutter. It's not one size fits all. And it's not easy and it's not quick, as you had mentioned earlier. It takes a lot of work and effort, but that is when you will kind of see the fruits of your labor, so to speak, that by doing that work is really how we can get to that aspect of healing and growth. And so in terms of what we do at TAPS and our postvention model, that ideally the quicker that we can connect with people, the soonest we can do that, days, hopefully hours, days, weeks, maybe months, or if they come to us after the fact, we can kind of meet them where they're at. But we want to meet those needs. We want to then give them opportunities, the venue, the platform, whatever it might be, to process their grief, their emotions, their trauma. So they might be getting connected to professional care with counseling. Maybe they're needing some treatment around trauma. Maybe they're connecting to support groups in local community, peer support connection. So whether that's, veteran with another veteran, a bereaved family member, like a spouse with a spouse, that we have found that that peer connection combined with professional care, whether it's, counseling or treatment, those are the things that have very hopeful outcomes, because we're fostering connection. We're fostering that sense of belonging and connecting to services. And when that happens, we usually will see, another shift in people, where they'll say, you know what, it, now that I look back and I see how, where I was at the time, I didn't know if I was going to, I didn't know how I'd make it through a week, let alone a month or a year. But, I went to a survivor seminar where I met other, our TAP suicide survivor seminar. I came to that event and I met people like me, or I went to a retreat, or I finally found a counselor who understood suicide loss, or maybe they went to a program that we've worked with partners to receive help for their trauma symptoms. And they're starting to notice some glimmers or aspects of healing within themselves, right? So there's another shift that can start happening when they start thinking about a more hopeful future ahead. There's, thinking about, who am I now? What have I learned from this tragedy? Maybe they want to give back. There's a meaning-making aspect here, a deeper sense of purpose, particularly when connecting to a community where they're not feeling so isolated. And that's when we oftentimes will have bereaved survivors who will say, you know what, you helped me so much in the beginning, or the services, or whatever that might be, that I want to give back now too. And so many times people then will become, a peer mentor themselves. And we have programs and trainings to help with all of that as well. And as we see many times in our military community, how peer connection is incredible. And many of those people then end up coming back and they work at TAP. So when you think, like, post-traumatic growth can look very different for everybody, but usually around finding a deeper sense of purpose, around there's a shift as well, from not just the moments of the death of their person who died or their loved one, but also the sense of hope for the future ahead, and that receiving the care was very helpful, but now maybe giving back, or maybe going back to school or a new career, or if nothing else, kind of embracing, that I'm worth it. I'm worth the effort that I put into it. And in spite of this tragic loss, there is hope ahead for myself. We also see a tremendous amount of advocacy at this point, where people want to, kind of speak up. They want to share their stories. We know that stories can be very healing and informative. They might help towards legislation and policy change. They might share their experiences that can help for prevention efforts, within different service branches. Kind of looking back, what might be improved, or changed to help with future prevention. So it can look very different, but we want people to know it's possible. It doesn't just happen automatically on its own. It does take the time and the work, but it also takes support. We can't do it alone, right? We need community to help us.
Well, thinking of that, I served in the Marine Corps in the late 90s, and you're absolutely right. There was none of this when I served. You were, if a situation like this happened, you saw the chaplain and hoped for the best.
Right.
And TAPS has been here for 31 years. At this time of this organization and your career, what is next for TAPS? Where are you all going with the services and advocacy you provide? Because I don't like assumptions, but I have to think that we're still learning about how the human mind processes grief and emotions and things like this to even, improve what we're doing.
Well, I think, again, there's a lot to reply to that too, right? As far as a nonprofit, we're not funded by the government. And so we're constantly, like anybody else, we're having to make sure that we're meeting the demands of that are coming to us. And unfortunately, that has not subsided. So constantly being able to meet the demands, meaning that we're able to provide the care and level of service to those coming to TAPS, which is, on any given day, we could have 25 to 27 new surviving family members, about a third, about 9 or 10 of those could be suicide loss. So unfortunately, the demand is still there. Loss is universal. We're not going to stop that from happening, but what we can learn about, particularly kind of prevention and protection and risk reduction, particularly around suicide, is critical. And as we're talking a lot about suicide loss survivors here, but in general, our bereaved individuals at TAPS who could have other causes of death, whether that is, illness, toxic exposure related illnesses and loss, accidents, training incidents, killed in action, those individuals also could find themselves in need of prevention. They might have times of emotional crisis or needing an intervention. So prevention and intervention is still paramount across the organization. Our helpline is a certified crisis line. Myself and other staff are trained in assist and other, suicide prevention training. So we take that very seriously. So we're always we're listening to those that we serve around the themes and the trends and what's needed. I think, expanding that and going forward, we're wanting to make sure that we're always providing the care to anybody who's impacted, including those with, within a unit or within leadership. We remain vigilant around that. We have, as you know, we have a very comprehensive communications team. So communication and messaging also is imperative, particularly when it comes to mental health, issues around kind of suicide related supports. Communication and messaging and safe and strategic messaging is key when we're looking at, reducing risk and reducing stigma. And so working with military leadership and all of the other organizations is a constant, right? Because our military community is vast and there are a lot of unique needs. One thing I think to address your question, which would be unique that I think we have always done, but there's still a great need, is addressing the military family and family members. So the family members of a veteran, or active duty. Many times there could be multiple service members within a family. It could be, a dual military serving family. There could be family members who are still serving and they may have, grieved somebody who has died or died by suicide. But we also have the spouses and the children of those service members or of those veterans who also could be at increased risk. And one of the things that TAPS does that is very rare with other organizations is we respond to that as well. There are still resources out there to help, but they might be time limited or there might be eligibility criteria with other agencies or organizations. So, in the case with suicide risk or in the tragic circumstances, if there is a suicide death of a family member, we need to make sure that we are supporting that service member or that veteran as well. And oftentimes that could be overlooked. And I think that is starting to change. We're starting to hear about the families, the military family members being involved more and more organizations that are meeting that. But I do think it's something to kind of keep an eye on to make sure we're not missing that.
You're a nonprofit, so support is needed to do and advocate and help people the way you need to. How can people connect with TAPS, help, provide assistance, and support what you all are doing, Doctor?
Sure. Well, our website is a great first stop for that. You can always call our helpline. It's on the website, and I think you probably will post it here, but 1-800-959-TAPS, 8277. But there are a lot of ways to be involved. First and foremost, if you're somebody who's been impacted by a loss, please don't hesitate. We stand ready to help you with that. We have a tremendous amount of volunteer opportunities. We have, for those who are in the military community, whether they're serving or they've already been separated out. We have a military mentor program where people can become involved and volunteer at our events and mentor a bereaved military child at some of our TAPS events, which is very powerful, kind of reciprocal in the sense that you oftentimes are also helped just by giving back to others. And of course, those who in leadership roles can become involved. And, as far as supporting and donating, we have that on our website as well. So we invite you in any capacity to be involved and call us or check on our website, and we'll be happy to help guide you through the process.
Winding down, doctor, I kind of want to tilt this back to the personal just for a couple questions. You experience this profound sense of loss, very real to you, and then you get involved and start with and work in TAPS. What's it like personally when you get to connect with somebody who's gone through the same thing, you've been through, and they go through the three phases, and then you see them really embrace their post-traumatic growth and find healing. What's that like for you, doctor?
Sure. Thank you for asking that. I will never forget the feeling that I felt, particularly in those early hours and days and weeks of feeling so isolated and alone and uncertain and scared. And I remember vowing to myself, holding my newborn baby. I'm kind of going back sharing this story, but not sure. I'm crying. I'm supposed to be embracing new life. The feelings were so conflicting and overwhelming, and I had so many questions. But I remember vowing to myself and to my newborn child that I had to find a way to survive this. And I didn't know how that would look, when that would happen, who would help. But if I could find a way through that in time, I would use my voice and my experiences, as well as my husband, who was not here to speak anymore, to either help those like himself so that lives could be saved, or those like myself who were impacted by that, so that they were not alone. And I really wanted to be a bridge within the military. I wanted to use these tragic circumstances to help, and I didn't know how to do that. And at that time, I was just a, well, I was going to say a young spouse, but then I was a very young widow. There was no voice at the table for that. No one was going to listen to me. That's really kind of what propelled me more professionally, because I knew I needed the education and the experience to be taken seriously. But that was so profound that I knew I had to dedicate myself to helping others somehow. And when I found my way to TAP, so this was probably maybe 15 years into my loss, but almost 18 years ago, I knew, like, all those years I was trying to find my people, and I finally found a place where I could give back. But when I, in my role at TAPS, when I'm talking to other new family members, I'm just one of them. I'm Carla. I've had a loss like you too. I don't know what you've been through, but I think I can relate in ways that, other people can't. And when I can lead with that, usually I can. Most cases, I can hear a sense of relief, because we help with people around the country and sometimes around the world, because so we have to do a lot of that remotely. Sometimes it's in person too when we get to finally meet, but there's a sense of relief. So leading with the peer connection is very powerful, because I can say, I've been there too, but you are not alone.
You're
And not
not
only
alone.
that, but I promise you that we will walk by your side, and you are going to survive this. I think that same message can resonate with service members and veterans too when they connect to a peer. And when you can say that from the heart, with this altruistic sense that when I say it, I mean it. I've lived it and I know it to be true. I know you can survive. I know it feels like you're the only one, that nobody can understand, that what happened was so complex that nobody's been through it. But I want you to know that you're not the only one, and you can get through this. It's too hard to do alone. And it's hard to trust, because We're vulnerable at that time too. How do we know that you're not going to take advantage of me or hurt me? And we trust our own instincts, you know? And so, the part of that is I always continue to learn, which is part of how TAPS has grown. We have learned from the survivors that we help, what do they need? How can we continue to meet those demands around what they're needing? And I don't like to say rewarding because that sounds kind of selfish, but I would say it's a reminder about I'm where I need to be and what we do matters. And so when somebody says, like as you shared, like, I didn't know if I would still be here today,
Would it be, just coin a phrase here, but would it be post-traumatic purpose?
Well, the purpose is as absolutely a part of that post-traumatic growth, having that deep sense of purpose, and it is very fulfilling. It is rewarding from an emotional perspective to feel like it's a renewal of purpose. This reminds me of I'm kind of steadfast, and maybe not everybody's going to take it to that extreme, or they might find their purpose in another sense. But you're absolutely right, because in the depth of grief and tragedy and trauma, you can lose sense of purpose. And so purpose in itself is yet another protective factor. When somebody has that sense of identity, the sense of connection, and a sense of purpose, we know that these things are very hopeful for the future. And so thank you for highlighting that. You're absolutely right. So I think a renewed sense of purpose, and hope, and a reminder, about what we do matters.
Last question. I've seen it on the website and socials, Love Lives On. I just want you to close with what that means to the organization and yourself, as we close out, Doctor.
Sure. I think it's important, as I mentioned earlier, that while tragic and filled with heart-wrenching grief, that, our loved one's life is not defined by the moments of how they died. There's a life of service and love and maybe before either they got sick or before tragedy struck. And so knowing that that lives on, that with grief, that love does not end. And I think that also says something about us as well, that the love for ourselves, the hope for our future can live on too. So I hope that that kind of leads with a sense of hope ahead, that grief in itself does not stop love, and that can continue with our legacy and our actions.
Carla, Dr. Strunk Patton, I just want to say thank you for sharing so openly and candidly about this very, real aspect of people's lives. The 22 a day is still there. It hasn't really gone down that much. And there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, a lot of worry during this time. And it's nice to know that TAPS is there. And I've learned so much, and I'll have a place to refer people if they go through this. I just want to thank you again for your time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for making the time and space to address this. We want people to know that in many cases, suicide is not inevitable, that there is help out there. With that help comes hope, and that sharing success stories about getting that help is a tremendous part of the conversation, for hope ahead. So thank you for highlighting that.
Again, I am with Dr. Carla Strunk Patton from TAPS. My name is Travis Oscar with Oscar Mike Radio. This is all about learning and learning how to help each other and help yourself. We appreciate your time. And as we say in Oscar Mike Radio, we're mission in flight. We'll see you next time.
Every generation, every sacrifice, our nation's service members have stood up for our freedom, our families, and our future. Now it's our turn to stand up for them. This year, you can honor their service in a deeply personal way by sponsoring a $17 Veterans Wreath. Each wreath is more than a symbol. It's a heartfelt tribute to the heroes who served and to the families who carry their legacy. Visit wreathsacrossamerica.org to sponsor a wreath today. This isn't just a wreath. It's a personal gift to an American hero.
Thank you for listening and watching Oscar Mike Radio, where our active duty service members and veterans are in action. And the mission is in flight. Oscar Mike Radio is an Oversized Load Co-Sinister-1 production. If you are a veteran or know a veteran who needs help, please dial 988 and press 1 for the Veterans Crisis Line.